Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Healthy Gut Girl, Kitty Martone, and this is Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. Welcome if you are new and this is the first time listening to my show. You've come in on a very advanced day. Yeah, we are talking today with Dr. Tyler Pansner. He has a PhD in molecular and cellular pharmacology, and he has decided to devote his work currently to genetics and to looking at the genetic information that people have. So for example, if you ever purchased your 23andMe or Ancestry.com or any of that, and you happen to also include your medical raw data with your order, a lot of them come with it, but I think that like the 23andMe, you have to request it, I think. He takes that material. So if you already purchased your genetic, Ancestry.com or whatever, he takes that. He runs it through a platform called Self-Decode. And you can do this yourself. You can actually purchase through him, and all his info is in the show notes. You can use his coupon code and you'll get a discount, and it will sort of like self-decode. It decodes your information, because unless you have a PhD in this yourself, looking at your raw data is, you might as well be looking at, you know, hieroglyphics from the Sumerian age. It's like impossible to read it. And so this self-decode goes through it, and it just basically turns it into really easy to read information. It's a cool, fun website. I did it. I used his coupon code, got a discount, and then had him on my show as another recommendation from Constantine. And it's mind-blowing. So this is what this episode is him basically talking about what he does and the importance of this genetic information for you as an individual and what he does with it. And then I'll tell you, I ended up hiring him and for a consultation, and then I'll tell you all about it after the show. Okay? All right. Enjoy. Dr. Tyler Pansner. So I am very excited about this because I have never delved into genes, genetic predispositions. I used to mentor under Dr. Robert Marshall, who is the guy who created Premier Research Labs nutraceuticals. And he used to talk about it. He was the first person I ever really heard bring it into his sessions with clients, and people would, especially when 23andMe popped up, they would bring in their stuff and he would talk about it. So that was the first time I'd ever really heard about it. And I got my 23andMe a while back, and then my friend Constantine, who turned me on to your work, he told me about Self-Decode. So I went through you and got my Self-Decode done, and it's like, it's a whole different ball game from just getting your 23andMe.
Oh yeah, it's light years ahead, and I never got sequenced through Self-Decode. Like, I uploaded my 23andMe data because the real specialty, it's not so much the sequencing, it's artificial intelligence that they use to extrapolate much, much more data out of that. And I really like that they're using called polygenic risk scores. So it's not just one individual mutation. They'll take hundreds of thousands of mutations into account to give you an overall stress score. So it's a lot more accurate. You can have things that make you more prone to stress and things that make you less prone. So how do you know what cancels out from each other? Mm-hmm. I use that platform. It's the framework for my one-on-ones with my clients. So by far the best platform, currently available at the moment. But I tend to go even one step further. I'm starting to call what I do hyper-personalized, not just personalized, because there's some recommendations. It's not just Self-Decode. It's all these other platforms, even some of these coaches. They'll look at one mutation. MTHFR is a big one. Are you familiar with that gene? Mm-hmm. People will say, take a methylated B vitamin. that could be asking for anxiety, stress, insomnia based on other mutations that people didn't take into account. On top of that, there's mutations that can make methyl B vitamins make you overmethylate. So, you know, it's a lot more nuanced than even self-decode, but I use that as a framework. If you built the platform around my brain, it never would be commercially available. You wouldn't know what the hell is going on. You know what I mean? So it's an awesome first start. And I always recommend for people I work with, anyone that's a health coach or really into health and fitness, I always recommend whether we work together, I order their kit and then send them their data and they upload it. I always suggest people that are very inquisitive, you know, to get the self-decode. I still can't believe it's so cheap overall, like for all that information you get, like really, really incredible. So yeah, really grateful for that platform. And they're adding a lot of new updates coming up soon. So excited for that. It just lets me do what I need to do much, much more, much more efficiently and much more thoroughly. And now that I'm, you know, starting to gain some momentum, more people reaching out, and it's, you know, it's endless one-on-ones may not be the answer because it's not too scalable. So I'm starting to realize that. So trying to figure out maybe some type of group coaching or semi-group coaching. You know, personalized medicine and group coaching are kind of opposites, but I do feel like I think people would be okay with sharing some of their health stuff because people would have similar things going on and make them feel like they're not alone. But yeah, super excited and really excited to kind of expand my stuff in the near future, offer some more packages and stuff, coursework, love educating people. So being able to do that, you know, to the masses, there's so many. I constantly seen supplement issues. People are taking the wrong things based on their genetics.
I want to definitely jump into that, but I'm realizing that a lot of people probably don't know what we're even talking about with the self-code. So it's basically, you can take your 23andMe or what's the other one? Ancestry.
Ancestry DNA. I mean, they take from at least a dozen, pretty much most of the bigger genetic companies, you could upload that data. So you upload that data, their artificial intelligence gets far more data. I think 23andMe is like, might be 45,000 mutations, and then that goes up to 100 million.
Oh my goodness.
So here's the catch, though. We don't know what the vast majority of those do. So we and this just goes to show that with the little bit we know about genetics, you can change people's lives, but there's so much more we don't know. So even though all the data's there, like one gene can be mutated in like 30,000 areas, and you get all that information. However, we have no idea what 99% of those do, not yet. Wow. So it's like, I love genetics too, because it's a one and done. Your genes are locked in. They're never changing. Yeah, there's epigenetics. You could change the expression of genes, but the genetic code, I think, is very undervalued. I think it's because a lot of people, people want to feel in control of their health and in their life. But even though the genetic code is written in stone, personalized, hyper-personalized supplementation and things, you know, what type of food you should be avoiding, like certain chemicals and foods that are naturally present in healthy foods may be bothersome to you. So you can be having a lot of issues from healthy foods, eating a clean diet. You could be deficient in key nutrients, very deficient. You could be more inflamed from healthy foods that other people regard as health foods just because everyone's so genetically different.
Right. So that is what I found super interesting, because obviously you said it's AI that kind of takes that information, you put it into self-decode, and it combs it out and it puts it all into categories and shows you your brain health, your cardiovascular health, and all your predispositions. And then it even has this little box that shows you the actual genes, like your top variants that most likely impact your genetic predispositions. It is so comprehensive that it's like daunting. So you need somebody like you to really help the person customize what's going on. But you said something very interesting. So that mentor I mentioned who used to talk about this stuff, he used to say, and I wrote it down, he used to say that we have this viral gene deck. A large part of our gene deck is viral. And I might be saying this wrong, but I'm just going to say it. And it's not meant to be flipped on. Like they're not meant, these genes, some of these genes are not meant to be flipped on, but like maybe it's meant to like decompose our bodies when we die. We don't know why that gene deck is there. But today he would say we're having such shocking levels of stressors, especially like EMFs and GMOs and all the things, and that these genes are getting flipped on, and people are turning up with Lyme disease and EBV who have never even been exposed to these things. Is this really happening?
So he might be referencing something called transposons, retrotransposons, and those we actually got, they're pieces of DNA that can hop, skip, and jump around in our DNA. We actually got them from viruses evolutionarily. So technically, a lot of our DNA is viral, and you could hop, you could copy paste genes in different areas, which can cause a lot of issues. I'm honestly not too familiar with like de novo. So out of nowhere, no infection, getting that infection, like EBV or something like that.
Yeah.
Off the top of my head, I want to say that doesn't make too much sense, but I'm definitely not an expert in that aspect. But definitely what he's mentioning at the bare minimum, epigenetic regulation. So epigenetics, that I think it would be more so flipping on genes that make you more prone to those viral infections. I think that stuff, you know, poor lifestyles make you so much easier to be able to get sick. So I definitely think that's the case. This also happens with childhood trauma. You can have that one imprinting event where it's a lot of trauma and the genes are skewed. So you're always going to be producing excess cortisol because you express it higher than usual. Or you could be less confident in yourself. Now, that's where the whole side of, you know, epigenetic spiritual healing, which I'm still a huge believer in as well, comes to play. So it's the nature versus nurture. You know, the nature is the genetic code. The nurture is more of, you know, the lifestyle, stress, relationships, which can affect the genes. Absolutely. But certain individuals with certain mutations, certain combinations of mutations, I could say, you can have one mutation and a gene works 90% as well. Or you can have four and it works 10% as well. So if you have a lot of those mutations there and it's barely functioning, 10% active, no amount of cold plunge, walks, sun exposure is going to be able to help you. You're going to be able, you're going to be needing targeted supplementation or possibly medication. But from my experience, I'm able to work with clients for a wide variety of issues without relying on pharmaceuticals at all.
Right. Okay. So what about, if I take this test, if I do my genetic testing, like the 23andMe, and all these, it shows I have MTHFR, it shows that I have these different variants, and then I have, and it shows in my life, you know, I have issues with detoxing, whatever. And then I see you, and then I get all of this wonderful program, and I start working on my life, and I remediate my gut and all the things. And then I take my test again. Do those genes show up, the variants show up in the same way? Are they shown as flipped on? Are they still there?
Yeah. So the genetic code never changes. So you could get 50 DNA tests throughout your life. It's going to be the exact same information. What you're referencing is something called epigenetic testing. So they'll see what genes are methylated or not, turned on or off. That's a much newer field of testing. I'm actually starting to reach out to a couple of companies that do this. I want to really vet and see how many genes they're really checking for that. The science isn't nearly as there as it is for regular genetic testing. It doesn't mean they don't work. I just know they're more expensive than regular genetic testing. So I definitely want to talk to, you know, the product development team and really understand the underlying science for it. And that's what me being a PhD, you know, molecular biology expert, that's what enables me to do. Really make sure, are we just checking a couple of genes here for, you know, $500-$600, or if it's really comprehensive. The thing with epigenetics too is there's no way to you can't choose, all right, I want to epigenetically change MTHFR, but not this gene. You know, it's kind of like all or nothing. Usually it's like beneficial genes or less beneficial genes. So there's not really, we don't have any research on how to, there's no real specificity with epigenetic regulation, if that makes sense. But that's your biological age is the methylation. Changes in methylation epigenetics dictate how you age. So I do eventually plan on incorporating that as I have more, you know, whether it's 3-6 month programs for people, and we test you beforehand, we test you after, because the one thing I want to get more of in my practice is quantitative data, not qualitative. What I mean by that is, people tell me I'm feeling better. We have some blood markers to go off of, you know, maybe C-reactive protein, inflammation goes down. maybe their vitamin D goes up, some stuff like that. But some more actual hard data that's you know, showing with numbers that you're improving. Mm-hmm. And that epigenetic age test that you mentioned, where you could see what genes are methylated, that's definitely a good way to do that. Like, let's just say you're 50 years old, you start working with me, and you have the epigenetic age of, I don't know, a 68-year-old. And then let's say we work together for 3-6 months, and then it's down to 41. You know, I'm throwing out numbers here. Like, I haven't dove into that yet, but you kind of get what I'm saying with that. Yeah. It's having more data to back it up. I'm also planning on incorporating some like mindfulness things where it's like a headband you put on with a phone app, and it reads the signals of your brain to train you. And you can actually get scores on how good your cognition is. You know, like imagine being able to show people, these are all my 100 clients, and look at the hard data for how much their cognition went up. And that's much more convincing to people. You know, testimonials are great. You know, like I have some really great testimonials on my website from clients, but being able to have that quantitative data is really, really cool. Aside from just saying, I feel better.
Yeah. Because sometimes people just get on a program and they're doing better because they started something new. And that would be amazing to be able to show that it's actually, exactly like you said. So I just wanted to make sure, going back to my original question, was just that I was even using that word properly with flipped on and off genes.
That's definitely true. That's what epigenetics is, flipping them on or off. Mm-hmm. I'm just not aware. Some of these epigenetic tests may test MTHFR, but yeah, definitely a newer emerging area that I'm currently investigating.
Cool. I mean, we all know about genetics loads the gun, lifestyle pulls the trigger. But like me looking at myself decode, there's a bunch of things here that make sense. But there's also a lot of things where I'm like, I do well with coffee? Really?
Yeah.
You know, because I absolutely don't. And, you know, there's a lot of things. So
you're saying the report told you do good with coffee.
It said that. And I don't. And and that I'm not prone to anxiety. And I am. And so tell me why, like, I know this is AI, but what am I trying to say? Like, how is it coming up with this? Or is it because my lifestyle? Okay, I'm going to use another example quickly. This is, you know, the blood, eat right for your blood type diet, right? And, you know, people do that and they're like, oh, I did so great on it. And I investigated that for a long time. And I was like, but it doesn't seem to be taking into consideration the fact that, it says I can do goat's milk, but the fact that I can't now because I got really bad food poisoning in India a year ago, and now I can't do any dairy for some reason. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's not taken into consideration what I've.
It's not dynamic. It's not changing. Yeah, exactly.
And so is that the same thing with these?
Before I get to that, you mentioned the genetics loads the gun, environment pulls the trigger. And I've kind of added my own spin on that. That's true. But some people are born with their trigger 90% pulled. That's kind of how I view this is, why do some members of a family that live in the same house, why do some get chronic mold constantly, all these environmental issues, others don't? They may have gotten certain combinations of mutations from mom and dad, because you can have children that are more genetically different than you think. Obviously, you could tell they're siblings, but there's a random chance on which genes get passed on by your parents. So, like my parents each had one copy of a gene mutation that make them break down histamine slower in all of their cells. Now, based on probability, I think there's like a 6 to 8% chance that it's just me and my little brother, that both of us, 25% chance that I have two copies, two mutations. And then there's a 25% chance my brother does. So in probability, that means roughly 6 to 8% chance that both of us got both of those mutant copies. We both did. So we both had significant histamine issues throughout our lives. My parents, not as much so. Somewhat because they have one copy of it. So, so certain individuals are getting, I guess, a worse genetic hand dealt to them, if that makes sense. Genetics loads the gun, environment pulls the trigger. Some people's genes make their trigger much easier to be pulled, whether it's partially pulled, however you want to word that. I think that's a really good way to sum up how I view all of this, because a lot of these environmental factors heavy metals or mold or parasites or gut dysbiosis. All of these things, the sensitivity that your body has to them are dictated by genes. You can have mutations in detoxification genes for specifically mercury or specifically lead. You can have mutations for nutrient deficiencies, so you can't make the main detox protein, metallothionein, the number one anti-heavy metal detox protein your brain has. I mean, your body has. So yes, obviously, you'll never get lead poisoning if you're never exposed to lead. But no matter what, we're all exposed to heavy metals and mold. You're going to come across mold in your life. You're going to come across mold spores. Why is it that some people get so sick from it? Are they really consuming that much more of these toxins, or are they just genetically sensitive? Obviously, it's always going to be a mix of both. You know, I'm never going to say it's only genes, but I feel like people act like it's 90-95% the environment, 5% the genes. I personally think it's at least a majority of the genes. Let's just say 51%. You know, I don't, I have no data to, you know, to prove the exact percentage, but from what I've seen, when I have a wide array of clients, some of them come to me with the mold, EBV, mast cell activation syndrome, and then some of them are just, you know, in pretty good health, just a little anxious, don't sleep that well, and want to think a little better during the day. And the correlation between people that are very sick and they have all these mutations, like combining mutations, synergizing, like I call it like a check engine light, you know, like a red light, like a red, like, oh, check this. This is significant, significant, significant. The correlation is astounding to me. And that's what leads me to thinking that I think the genes have a huge role in dictating how sensitive you are to your environment. And that's why some of us are getting sicker than others. But what you said about the self-decode, that's just because no matter how great self-decode is, it's still an imperfect system. Meaning, like I said, we don't know what the vast majority of these mutations actually do. So we're going off of what data we currently have. A lot of the reports will be like, oh my God, that's spookily accurate. Yeah. Like sometimes I've seen some clients that say prone to low thyroid and prone to high thyroid, like in the same person. You know what I mean? So, yeah. That's why it's very useful, but like you got to take all of it with a slight grain of salt. You know, if someone tells me they have bad anxiety and their stress report doesn't say increased risk, I'll still click on that and it'll still give you mutations that can give you a recommendation, if that makes sense. So that's why I say I use self-decode as a framework, not as gospel, because I think that's mainly meant for the interface is meant for non-genetic expert doctors to make a couple recommendations, you know, with the smiley faces, the colors, you know, it's not, I would prefer to have just all data there, but that's not very pretty to sell to people. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so I would the technology, shut down if I saw all data.
Yeah, exactly. So the technology that it's built on is by far the most advanced. And that's why with how my brain works, I want to push the envelope and innovate on this. That's why I chose them as a platform. For me personally, the aesthetics presentation of the platform, you know, doesn't really jive with me that well, but overall it's a massive, massive net benefit. You know, I'm not going to bitch and complain to build it around my brain, like I said.
Right. Yeah, no, the smiley faces kept me engaged. So
yeah, working as intended.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay. My big thing is that I started off really with gut health and my own stuff and, working with Donna Gates, who's the author of the Body Ecology Diet, and just doing all this stuff with, fermented foods. And then I had some issues of my own, some hormonal issues of my own that were not getting rectified just because I was, you know, remediating my gut. I had like a great gut all of a sudden, but I still couldn't get pregnant or I couldn't stay pregnant. And I couldn't, you know, and I was anemic and all these other things. So I started the estrogen dominance support group on Facebook, and that was 8 years ago. And so we have like, I don't know, 25,000 members. It's an active group of women, mostly women. And so we try to talk about the hormone component with genes and how things just seem like they're so much worse. Like when I started the group, it seems like the age of the women that were joining were all heading into perimenopause.
And how long ago was this? Like how many years ago was this
eight,
started?
8 years.
Eight years. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And now I have 22-year-olds whose doctors are telling them that they're in perimenopause. And I have, you know, mothers who have 9-year-olds and 8-year-olds with, you know, double D's, breast size, and they're clotting and having massive periods at that age. Yeah, it's getting really scary. And so I want to know if this is an epigenetic thing. What's your take? Because I know you're seeing a lot of it as well, I'm sure, in your practice. What do you think? What's your take on this with, from a genetic perspective, but also just from your smart mind?
Yeah, so I definitely think genetics are at play. One of the mutations I have that makes me break down adrenaline slow also makes me break down estrogen slow. So I actually tend to skew towards estrogen dominance as well. So I take some things here and there to help lower the estrogen. I take things to help raise testosterone. I haven't had really major issues because of that, but just subtle things that I noticed that like could be a little bit better, like holding a little bit of fat on my chest area, you know, like kind of the last spot for me to lose it, a little more of an estrogenic type of thing. Mm-hmm. And I definitely think one of the major things I think are the pollutants. So a lot of things that are mimicking estrogen. I think like Hashimoto's disease, the most common autoimmune disease, is mostly female. I think a lot of that's because of all the cosmetics that women use. They're exposed to a lot more chemicals that dysregulate hormone pathways. And another point I want to make too is that it may not always just be the hormones. And what I mean by that is estrogen regulates histamine. So if you have mutations that mean you break down histamine slower than normal, which for the record are extremely common, I think histamine is a significant driver to virtually everybody's health issues. It's not just coughing, sneezing. If it's high histamine in the brain, anxiety, depression, brain fog, ADHD, OCD. If it's skin, hives, psoriasis, eczema, acne. If it's the gut, IBS, Crohn's, bloating, diarrhea, constipation, joints. So basically all these different organs can accumulate histamine. And if you think about it, if your estrogen rises, and that's why actually a lot of PMS symptoms and menstrual cramps are actually linked to high histamine. So your cycle comes, estrogen goes up, that slows down the breakdown of histamine, which leads to these, some of these PMS type irritable brain fog type symptoms. So It can definitely be the estrogen. But it's also what does estrogen affect? So you can have mutations.
You said estrogen regulates histamine.
They're tightly regulated.
It's controlling the histamine and why it's released or why it's cleared or how.
Yes, there's a lot of other inputs for histamine aside from just that. That's why everything, look at a cell signaling pathway. It's like a big network. It's like a spider web. You know, it's never rarely just linear like that. There's a lot of inputs, cellular inputs that cause your cells to make and release histamine. But estrogen does, this has been very well demonstrated, to slow down the breakdown of histamine. So women that I've worked with that have issues with their cycle, painful periods, helping to support the histamine. And a lot of times I see these histamine type mutations in there. So, you can absolutely have things that are mimicking estrogen. So higher estrogen, if you already have higher estrogen genetically, you could break it down slower. Then you have these things that mimic estrogen on top of that. You know, then with your cycle, it goes up even more. Then on top of that, you break down the histamine slow to begin with, and all that estrogen slows it down even more. You see how this is like very, very nuanced, and it's all, I think of like a Lego set. You're building up a Lego set of things. You know, it's not just one thing like that. And that's why I'll look at mutations and there's no clinical data connecting it to things, but that's because they're only investigating one mutation. If that makes sense. So it's like no one's assessing all these different Lego pieces because that's harder to do. But as long as you trust the science and trust that these mutations do something, one mutation on its own may not do that much. But again, on top of the lifestyle, and then there's also mutations in how you activate these environmental toxins. So you can have mutations, so these air pollutants and stuff, you actually activate more, so they're more toxic for you. You activate them into an activated state. So the non-activated state isn't as bad as an endocrine disruptor. But if you have a mutation to activate it more than normal, that same dose for you is going to mess up your hormones more than someone else. So add that Lego piece to it, you know, see building this all up. And a lot of it's just pattern recognition. Like from my point of view, I asked myself, well, it's going to sound crazy. Is it really this easy? Like now that I'm getting this workflow down, it's like, I can see these patterns like, oh, it's this. And like, it's working amazing for me. Obviously I know what I know that not a lot of people understand, but from my point of view, it's like, it's following the data. It's pretty straightforward with that stuff. Estrogen dominance. Yeah, it's definitely getting worse with all the things we're putting in our bodies, all the things that we're exposed to, heavy metals. And like I said, all of these are ultimately dictated by genes because they make proteins, and that's how your cells transmit any sort of signal. You need to have a receptor for something to bind to. You need to have an enzyme to degrade it. And all of these things, virtually all of these things, can be mutated. So all these people try to convince you that their product is good for you, but I actually have the tools to tell you what's really good for you.
Right.
New client, I was just doing her report with Lyme disease, and she's very anxious. She breaks down adrenaline slow. She's on this liver support supplement with a bunch of supplements that raise adrenaline. They help with histamine. They help with gut inflammation, but they also raise adrenaline. So her number one thing was energy, then stress. And the energy could be a lot of different issues, but just goes to show those supplements that people use for antihistamines can be very harmful. Like if I take something like quercetin, very commonly used for mast cell stabilizer, I will be off the deep end, so irritable, so anxious, thinking my life is over, not be able to sleep that night because I break down adrenaline 4 times slower than a normal person, which means I also break down estrogen roughly 4 times slower. So, you know, see what I'm getting at here. Like I could find, and that's one of the things I really want to be more vocal about is the harms of supplements. I would say out of those clients that I work with that come to me already taking supplements, I would say at least 50% of them are taking at least one thing that's not agreeing with their genetics, making their overall health situation worse. I've had women come to me with their hair falling out, extremely anemic, ferritin super low, and they're taking all these iron supplements with vitamin C to boost absorption. Well, what else are they also taking? Their holistic practitioner also put them on this crazy double strength liposomal curcumin. What does curcumin do? It lowers inflammation. Sure. They always advertise it. Better brain health, better gut health, lower inflammation, arthritis, et cetera. It also chelates iron out of your body. So she's taking this curcumin while drinking her iron supplement every day. She's just pulling all of it out. Her body can't even take it in. She's pulling it out from all of her cells because that special liposomal, you know, 2000% extra absorption curcumin, you're going to get 200 times better anti-inflammatory effects. But it's also going to enhance all the other effects. It's also going to enhance 200 times more iron chelation. So she's going to all these different experts, hair regrowth experts. I'm like, get rid of the curcumin. Get rid of the curcumin. She had to like stop taking her iron supplement, and she was just eating red meat, and she got her iron levels back up. She was on that for like 5 years, just keeping going, going, going over time, making her hair fall out. And I see this all the time with people, and it's, you know, it's tragic because everyone means well. You know, this is not, people just aren't even aware of this level of nuance for the supplements. And I consider whether it's a pharmaceutical drug or magnesium or curcumin, to me, they're all drugs because a drug by definition is something that alters biology or physiology. You take magnesium, you're going to be less stressed. You're going to sleep better, probably less muscle cramps. That's a drug by definition. Now, Do I say like to my wife, hey, did you take your drugs this morning? Take your vitamin. Like, I don't, you know, I don't word it like that. You know what I mean? But like by definition, I've seen people with properly used pharmaceuticals, like a properly timed SSRI after a tragic loss in the family. They're on it for 2-3 months to stabilize. Then they come off of it. That can save their life. It can.
Yes.
They're on for two. A lot of people are on. Most people are on it for way too long. But I've seen pharmaceuticals work extremely well and change people's lives. Yes. I've also seen people on natural supplements ruin their lives or spend years with these health issues that the supplements are actually causing. And that's why I think it's so important to educate about the pharmacology of these things. And that's where, you know, my education, a PhD in molecular and cellular pharmacology, an expert in not only how cells behave while healthy and what changes when cells are diseased, but how things, drugs, vitamins, any of this stuff, how any molecule interacts with a human cell to change its overall functioning. And then I've kind of layered my own interest in genetics. So my PhD wasn't in genetics. I took genetics courses, but even that, all the stuff that I do now, all of this is all pretty much like self-taught just through reading so many different papers because no one's looking at it from this angle.
Yeah. Amazing. That was so well said. And I'm going to go back to the comment I made earlier about when I started, you know, 17 years ago, when I started working with gut health and all this, and working with children with disabilities and autism and trying to remediate their guts. And back then, these people, not just the children, but taking supplements and them doing what they're supposed to be doing, right? They take a digestive enzyme and it helps them digest their food. They take something, you know, ox bile or whatever, magnesium. And then all of a sudden, in the last, I'm going to say 8 years, 7 years, it seems like these crazy reactions to something like magnesium, crazy reactions to digestive enzymes, you know, or like the oxalate sensitivity is off the charts right now. And so I am super, you know, like when I recommend supplements, I'm like, you know, let's talk about this at length because it's a little bit sketchy now because I feel like people are so much more sensitive, or are they just more vocal about it now because they weren't connecting the dots?
I definitely think it's a blend of both. But yeah, because there's genetic mutation. Like one of the Self-Decode reports says oxalate sensitivity, and that's very black and white. Then there's also, you know, certain bacterial infections or fungal infections in the gut. Those can also slow down the breakdown of oxalates. So it's never only the genes. Now, can some genes dictate how at risk you are for a gut fungal infection? Yes. But at the end of the day, you need to have that fungus there in the first place. Yeah, that's very interesting. What type of symptoms were you normally seeing regarding the sensitivity to like magnesium? Because I know magnesium, I think I've narrowed that down to some people don't respond well to magnesium. I think it may actually be a sensitivity to the stearic acid, S-T-E-A-R-I-C, stearic acid. And most magnesium products have that in there. I forgot the reason why they have it in there off the top of my head.
I think
but,
it's
you know,
like magsterate, like that. It's a, like yes. An well, it, the, that they the, use to encapsulate it or to grease.
Yeah, I think it's something so like that. Yeah. Yes, something like that. Yeah. So I have noticed that for some people. And then what
Dr.
was the other
Marshall
one you mentioned?
Used to say that actually would the body would treat that like a trans fat, like a PUFA. And if you have like liver stagnation and you're taking magnesium, you're taking like 12 supplements a day, let's say, and you do that every day, that you're essentially really burdening your liver, which goes back to what you were saying, which is like,
well, definitely
damaging, you know, our bodies with.
And a lot of supplement sensitivities too, like you just mentioned, most of them do stem back to poor liver function. Usually a lot of the time when you feel like crap having, it's one thing to have a certain mechanism not agree with you. Like if I take something that raises adrenaline, no matter what dose I take, like unless I literally open a capsule and take a couple sprinkles, you know, any dose, I'm off my rocker. But that makes sense because that mechanism doesn't agree with me. Mm-hmm. If you're just reacting to everything, that's most likely a liver issue because that's what ultimately processes these things. I remember years ago when I was starting to get into supplements and stuff, I feel like a lot of us go through this phase where we take too many supplements. And I always had really bad bags under my eyes and I was stressing my liver out. My liver enzymes were super high from taking so many supplements together. And this is before I was doing any genetic, this is early in my PhD, just reading on how they function with the cells. But now that I layered on top of it, the genetic component, like I hear horror stories about people being put on 15, 20, 25 supplements all at once from someone. And I'm like, that is crazy. And on top of that, a lot of these products are like 20 ingredient herbal blends that can all have interactions with your body. You have no idea what's doing what. I mean, I'd say maybe around eight to 10 things that I use with my clients starting out, depending on the individual. But I use, aside from a multivitamin, a high quality one that's matched to your genetics, I pretty much only use single ingredient or low ingredient count things. Like, I really never use things that are more than three, maybe four, but most of my stuff are individual nutrients for the cells, because we need to be precise about this. And, you know, they usually spread out throughout the day, usually a little bit right before breakfast. If there's some gut health stuff, you know, to help nourish the gut, breakfast, vitamins, stuff you need with food, maybe some stuff during the day. If you're prone to being anxious, to have a tool in the toolkit, if you are feeling a little overwhelmed, because some of us are just triggered very easily in the world today. Is it really our problem, or it's the world that we're in? You know what I mean? And then usually some stuff to unwind later in the day, because I think too, a lot of people get so hung up on being so holistic, no supplements, none of that, just everything. But I think virtually everyone needs to be supplementing, because unless you're off the grid growing all your own food or getting all grass finished everything, which is a crap. I'll be totally honest, I don't eat grass fed. I still shop at Costco, Whole Foods for some stuff. I'm not totally fully organic.
Yeah.
I take stuff like She Legit. I take things that are overall net benefit to me, because it's a significant cost as well. You know, like, it's all about pros versus cons. You know, as I get more successful, this and that, I could afford that. Once I have, you know, I got out of school, what, less than 2 years ago, you know, so I'm still new to actually, you know, making any sort of money being out of school. But down the road, you know, once I can afford that, that's the first thing I'll spend that money on. But I still feel the best I felt not having all organic everything. So it's a real balancing act. And, you know, at the end of the day, we're all going to die eventually someday. And, you know, if I'm out grocery shopping with my wife and we see something we want to snack on, there's canola oil in it, guess what? I'm going to get it, because we both work from home and we cook all our own food. And I'm 100% gluten-free, low histamine diet, found foods that agreed with me, you know, 90-95% of the time. And that's all you can ask for, because the stress about some of these things, that's another thing I try not to freak clients out about, is not bombard them with all these crazy diet changes. I don't, as of right now, I'm not, I give information about what types of foods, what chemicals in foods you're more sensitive to. But as of right now, I'm not doing full meal plan type stuff. I definitely plan on doing that in the future, but I kind of just tell them, look at a couple articles. If you see the same food you eat every day coming up for high oxalate, limit it or remove it. You know, a lot of people get so scared in their own heads, and they're so stressed to take anything or do anything. And that stress is really bad for your health overall. That could be doing more harm than having that little bit of canola oil. Now, obviously going to eat out, you know, a burger fried in vegetable oil or French fries, you know, I'm not saying that, but like, I'm human too. You know, I also drink. I also drink. And when I drink, I do drink to get drunk. I like how it feels. You know, it's way less, drink way too much in college and stuff. It's still very few and far between, maybe, I don't know, maybe twice a month, if that. But I also take things to help my body break down that neurotoxin. So, you know, but people, to each his own. But some people act like, any amount of alcohol isn't that safe. But me doing it twice a month to spend time, be loose with my friends, this and that, like, to me, it's the pro outweighs the cons. And that's, I could find, you could find a scary mechanism about, give me any supplement, I can do a propaganda fear mongering why you should never take it. And it would scare the shit out of people, knowing what I know. But you could also find infinitely good things. So it's all about the pros versus cons for you. And if a certain supplement like curcumin, for example, really good for inflammation. But let's just say if you're anemic, you shouldn't do that. There's other things we can do. I'm a big fan of CBD. That works very well for inflammation. High quality stuff. That works well for inflammation. Doesn't affect those iron levels. Or if you have hereditary hemochromatosis and you have excess iron, iron overload, then curcumin may be perfect for you. But you want to check the iron and not do it for too long.
Right. Balance is what you're talking about for sure. It's balance with, you know, the drinking and all the things and how you feel after that, you know?
Yeah.
And so you have a fast comp, is that right?
Oh, slow.
No, I do. I have fast comp. You have slow comp. What does that mean?
Yeah. So that means the breakdown of dopamine, adrenaline, and estrogen primarily, just means we break that down slower, quicker. And now this also goes to show you have it's more so normal and slow. It's not so, I guess you could say it's fast and slow. That's fine as well. So like you having a fast COMT, estrogen is metabolized through multiple different pathways. So it's not like, like you're in an estrogen dominance group. You've had estrogen dominance, but you don't have a slow COMT. So you see how it's not always that one gene did that, at least regarding estrogen. Dopamine, adrenaline, there's only two real enzymes that break it down. So if one of yours is slow, you're going to put a lot of burden on that other one. So regarding the dopamine anxiety type stuff, COMT alone, like I could tell just by talking to a lot of people within the first 20 seconds, if they have a slow COMT enzyme, I can kind of just tell they're very, very, very outgoing, very, very excitable, and just super like pumped up for stuff. Not saying, you know, you have a fast one, not that you're like a drag or anything, you know what I mean? Like, but like, I could just tell. And you can also have mutations in something called the MAO enzyme. So this also breaks down adrenaline. So it's one of these two enzymes, but a lot of people I see with severe anxiety, both of those are mutated for them. Just my COMT is mutated, not my MAO. But some people are both of them. So that's a double whammy. Think about the Lego set I was saying before. You know what I mean? Like both of those are mutated. So that's a double whammy there. And there's a lot of supplements that can inhibit those enzymes. And they're going to be super, super sensitive. Like I've seen so many people, I'll make a post about it. And they'll be like, I'll get like 10 DMs. Oh my God, I looked at my adrenal support blend. It had half of these ingredients here. I removed it for a day. And this is the best I felt in like a year. Because boom, they were put on an adrenal support supplement because it fixes adrenals. Well, how does it fix adrenals? There's a lot of different mechanisms by how which it can do that. These ingredients raise adrenaline. But if you already have genetically higher adrenaline, that's not the adrenal supplement for you. Like people, I know if you heard of, like rhodiola, rosea, and ashwagandha?
Sure.
They're both adrenal support supplements, yet they function completely differently. Rhodiola jacks up adrenaline, serotonin, and dopamine. I can't take any of that. I will be same like the quercetin, you know, that same, it blocks that enzyme. Ashwagandha numbs me out. So it brings you down. The other one brings you up. Yet people will have them in like the same product blend, which to me makes no sense. Why are you going to be slowing your, like people say, don't have uppers and downers. You know, I don't get why you would do that, but people just do that because that's what people do, because in all the BuzzFeed articles, this or that, they help with adrenals. Great. You know, it's not personalized at all, but even the ashwagandha side of stuff, that's another supplement I've seen cause a lot of issues for people. It can really numb you out and take away your enjoyment from life. It's called anhedonia, lack of pleasure for things. It tanks your cortisol, which can be good for extreme anxiety cases. I try that. I'm so chill. I don't want to do anything. I'm kind of just a bump on a log, just kind of like blob, like meh, whatever to everything. You go on forums, a lot of people see that. I think that's mainly because it blocks a certain serotonin receptor, the serotonin 1A receptor. Now, some people can have mutations where that receptor doesn't work as well. So if you're blocking a receptor that already doesn't work as well, you're going the wrong way. You know, you're going to be extra numbed out from that. I work with clients that they're, you know, they have this lack of energy, just feeling blah overall. They've been on 2 grams of ashwagandha for the past 3 years because someone told them it helps with stress. We remove that. Now we need to replace it with something else because their body's rebounding so much. They've been suppressing their cortisol all the time. That's why they're tired. Someone with that receptor mutation that needs more stimulation, CBD, CBDA, lavender, all three of those help stimulate that serotonin receptor. So you see how deep this can go. That person should not do ashwagandha at all, but they would benefit from CBD, CBDA, lavender. Now, why would we pick CBD versus lavender? CBD, I love it. I take it every day. It affects the metabolism of about 80% of prescription medications. I see people accidentally overdosing. And by overdosing, I mean, let's just say you're given 5 milligrams of an antidepressant medication. If you have that and have CBD every day, your body may respond as if it's 8 milligrams instead of 5. So you'll be feeling off and weird. You're taking CBD every day. Now they put on bottles. You ever seen like drug bottles don't have grapefruit juice? That's because it blocks the enzymes that break down the drugs. CBD does the same thing. A lot of other, so there's the adrenaline side of supplements I mentioned. There's like histamine, blood sugar, but there's also a lot of natural herbs affect the metabolism of medications, and people are on them. The doctor did not prescribe the dose accounting for these herbs. A lot of these detox blends do that as well. So there can be a lot of things, a lot of people's issues. They're working to get, they're spending money on things that are making them feel worse. And that's why I tell people, like, you know, like, I personally think for all the value you're getting, I'm extremely affordably priced. If anything, I think it's undervalued, honestly. But people say, I have $4,000-$5,000 of supplements in my closet. I have no idea what's doing what. I'm like, well, you could have worked with me and figured all that out for a friend. You could have worked with me, bought all the supplements that I wanted you to get for the next year straight, and still had several thousand dollars left over to, you know what I mean? It removes all the guesswork.
And I mean, you're also, in a way, you know, really setting up a good argument for regulating everything. I'm not for that.
Yeah,
but it,
yeah.
It definitely is, like, you know, that would be a good argument for that. Because,
well,
I had
a rant I did a couple of weeks ago or a month ago or whatever. And I was basically saying, sort of on this topic, how I'm just getting fed up with seeing all these people on the exactly wrong nutrients given to them by other accredited professional healthcare professionals. And again, it's just because they don't have an expertise in pharmacology. You know, there's nothing malicious or bad. They're trying to do their best. This is not a knock to them at all. I don't, you know, everyone's doing the best they can. People have different areas of expertise, but how many natural practitioners use supplements, and how many of them have a training in pharmacology? Extremely, extremely, extremely few of them. So I actually did a poll and asked people, what do you guys think about regulating natural supplements? And it was pretty much split down the middle.
Really?
Yeah. And I think it ended up skewing more towards no. It started out 50-50. I think it ended up being maybe like 65-ish% no. But the more I think about it, you know, I think it's a bad idea to limit these for anybody. If someone wants to go on their own accord and go into Vitamin Shoppe and get whatever supplements they want, go ahead. Because everything I'm suggesting to you, you could go get on your own anyways. Mm-hmm. But I do think, I'm not sure if I'm 100% sure on this, but like, I'm kind of leaning towards this. If you are a healthcare professional and you are suggesting, prescribing, whatever you want to call it, natural vitamins and supplements that are over the counter, I think you should have to get some sort of basic training on, even if it's 6 hours of lectures, that's something that I teach or something like that. I think you should take some training on supplement pharmacology so you can understand these things and have a list of stuff that interacts with which classes of medications. Mm-hmm. If you're making that as a professional recommendation to someone, I think you should have some sort of official education on how these things work. Now, you don't need a PhD in it, obviously. I'm not saying that. You know what I mean? But like, I think if you're a professional suggesting to others, now any friend can suggest any friend, whatever. That's where it's, I'm under the impression, like, if you want to mess your own body up, go ahead. I think your body, your choice. And that should be across the board for everything, not to get political or anything. That's kind of how I am with it.
Like, you know, it's like guns. It's like cars. It's like, are you going to get in the car and drive down the street without a license, without learning how to drive? Or are you going to go skiing and never took a lesson? It's just self-responsibility. It's personal responsibility.
Yeah.
And, you know, to what degree are you going to want people's choices to be regulated or whatever? But yeah, if you're going to be prescribing a whole protocol for someone who's not well, you know, they need to know. I think that it would be helpful to know what the drug interactions are. Absolutely.
Yep. And the same thing goes for conventional doctors as well. Like, they ask what medications you're on. They don't really ask what supplements. And I guarantee you, they don't know that CBD affects the metabolism of 80% of medications. They have no idea, but they don't ask that.
Right. I mean, you know, let's not forget that, you know, the third leading cause of death in the United States is, you know, medical error. But I wanted to ask you a couple things because you struck a chord in me. First of all, with your inability to break down adrenaline rapidly or normally, what does that do for you when you work out? So when you go work out and you do like a HIIT training, or do you not do HIIT training? Like, do you do CrossFit? You look like you do something intense.
Yeah, no. So I do more, I used to do, I had a lot of injuries. Like I partially tore my pec, a couple this and that, lifting very heavy. Now I do more hypertrophy bodybuilder style training. So I'm not lifting relative to my size. I'm not lifting weights that are that heavy, but I'm just really contracting the muscle and just trying to build up that skeletal muscle, have good insulin sensitivity. I am a big fan of HIIT training, and I wouldn't say so much that it's like I can't tolerate high rates of exercise. Like that type of adrenaline isn't too much of an issue for me, if that makes sense.
How can I ask you your age?
30.
Okay. So I wonder how that will work out as you age. Like for a woman, I would say if you're having issues with adrenaline, like we work a lot with bioidentical progesterone. And when some women start to take bioidentical progesterone, it stimulates estrogen. And then they get this estrogen kickback thing and they start to get adrenaline issues and all these other things happen. But if you're in perimenopause and menopause, we're like definitely avoid HIIT training and things that get you up at that point where you're. And
I agree with that for sure.
So I'm curious about somebody who can't break down adrenaline well. Like when you're younger, you know, your body's robbing Peter to pay Paul, I like to say, like, right? It makes those concessions for you. It figures it out for you. And then you get to this certain age. I don't know if it's the same with men where your body just doesn't do that anymore. It can't, it doesn't have room for error. And now that adrenaline mutation thing you have becomes, okay, now I can't even make that adrenaline. I can't even get to that point because I'm going to end up with insomnia and I'm going to blah, blah, blah. What do you think of that?
Yeah. And I think part of it too, like there's absolutely, you know, aging
sucks.
It's, you're never going to escape it. It absolutely plays effect on human biology. But I also think too, by the time you start aging, you spent several decades on Earth. Most people are not giving their cells the proper nutrients, which, okay. So like, I have started working with people with more clinical diseases. So Alzheimer's, autism, ALS. And like, it's the same workflow that I do with people that don't have those, that just have anxiety or mold or whatever, but it's all connected. You look at any of these diseases, there's a heavy metal connection. There's a low vitamin D connection. There's a high histamine connection, low glutathione. So like, I think that the same mutations that weren't addressed through personalized supplementation and lifestyle changes as you were growing up over decades, that's what leads to these same diseases. So obviously aging is a huge aspect of it, but I also think it's, you've been living 40, 50, 60 years with that mutation that makes you require much more of, I don't know, carnitine or much more of, you know, vitamin C or much more of this or that, much more of histidine, which is used to make histamine. So if you're dumping a lot of histamine, you won't have enough histidine. This is a tongue twister. You won't have as much histidine to make metallothionine, which will detox your heavy metals. So maybe you have all these heavy metal issues that are leading to your dementia because you lived your whole life without histidine. You didn't give yourself enough of it. So imagine knowing these things. Imagine you knowing your cells' Achilles heels, the top five pathways, let's say, that need support, because any given disease has infinite flavors. Like I said, Alzheimer's can be linked to methylation issues, high histamine, low vitamin D, low glutathione, heavy metals, ApoE4, which is disrupted lipid signaling. Those are just six of them I mentioned there. Wow. Now, everyone's a pie chart. So let's say one person has, you know, there's no real way to exactly test this per se, at least not yet, but one person can have more, theirs is, you know, 30% vitamin D, the rest, everything else. Someone else is 10%. You know, there's different individual contributors to this. So I look at someone, like I've had a few Alzheimer's clients and I look at them. Some of them have much more heavily mutated vitamin D pathways. Some of them have more histamine. Some of them have mutations in how they synthesize and conjugate glutathione to reactive oxygen species. So imagine if that person that had all the vitamin D issues, imagine they just had optimal vitamin D their entire life, optimal for them, which may be higher than normal on the blood work. because there are mutations that make your cells not, if you have a mutation in a receptor, not how you synthesize, a receptor, that means your cell is less receptive or responsive. So a lot of people have mutations in vitamin D receptors. So their blood levels may look okay, but their cells are actually deficient in the signaling because they're not as sensitive to it. So everyone's like, don't vitamin D. I'll have people have like 90, level 90 on vitamin D, which is the very high end of normal, but they have four mutations in the vitamin D receptor. We bring them up there. They're like, oh my God, I'm going to get all calcified because they've been fear mongered by people in the holistic space, and they feel the best they felt because they have to take a pretty high dose because of their unique mutation. So that's why I do use blood work. I use it as a foundation though, because blood work is A, checking what's in the blood, not inside of your cells. You can have mutations that mean you don't transport vitamin B12 through your blood into your cells. Same with vitamin D. All these nutrients have transport proteins. If those are mutated, you can have normal B12 levels because it's sitting in your blood, not getting into your cells. You give them something like lithium, low dose lithium, that helps transport inside of their cells. They'll go from not feeling their B complex to boom. That next day, they're lit up like a Christmas tree because they're actually bringing it inside of their cells. So going back to what I mentioned, you know, the different flavors of these different diseases. Imagine if your main issue was, let's just say, vitamin D and glutathione. So let's give you vitamin D, all the cofactors. And then, yeah, maybe some nitric oxide as well to help boost. And if you look, nitric oxide is also linked to Alzheimer's. So it's like all these trials that we use for diseases, it's checking this drug that bombards this one pathway. Is it or is it not effective for the treating this disease? Well, why does it work better for some people? Let's take an SSRI, for example, for depression, like a Zoloft or Lexapro. Some people respond much better to those than other people because some people need more serotonin. Other people don't. They don't even check your serotonin levels before they give you this drug. What if it's a dopamine mutation? Histamine is linked to depression. Vitamin D. So those same things I mentioned for Alzheimer's can also – so you'd – like it's all the same causes. We don't know exactly why some people it's depression, other people it's Alzheimer's. You know, these same pathways. Like that's why when I list my packages, I could help with anxiety, depression, joint pain, gut health, fertility, longevity, sleep, energy, like 12 different things I list. How can you help all those things with one package? All I'm doing is supporting the cell pathways that need to be supported. And then depending on the person that has different issues, it can help those things. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
There's not an Alzheimer's, APOE4 is not an Alzheimer's disease mutation. It disrupts lipid transport, cholesterol transport. So that can be linked to cardiovascular disease because that involves lipids or triglycerides. It can also do that in brain cells and lead to Alzheimer's. So it's not – everyone's like, oh, APOE4 is an Alzheimer's mutation. No, it's a lipid transport mutation that plays a role in the pathology or development of Alzheimer's.
Wow. I mean, that goes back to the beginning of this discussion. All the women on my mom's side of the family died with complications of Alzheimer's. And my mom's already in her late 70s and she's not really showing signs yet. But
once you show signs, that's already, you know, hate to say it, sort of the beginning of the end.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like right. It's same thing with cancer. Like cancer takes, I studied breast cancer during my PhD. That's what my thesis work was on. And cancers take decades to grow. That from when that first cancer cell gets mutated to when it grows and forms a tumor and metastasizes, that can take 10, 20 years easy. So you're getting a diagnosis age 55 with breast cancer, you were getting that in your early 30s. That started in your late 20s. So it matters now.
Yeah. Well, so yeah, looking at my self-decode, it's showing that I do have a, you know, predisposition to cognitive decline and to Alzheimer's. And so, but what you're saying is that if we dig into that data, it might be multiple pathways that are
exactly
contributing to that. It's not like, oh, you were born with brown eyes. It's not like that. It's like there are multiple things that contribute to that.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's a great, that hit the nail on the head, because a lot of people view things as, I have this symptom, say anxiety. What drug or supplement do I take to fix the anxiety? There's not just a stress pathway. There's many different inputs that not only make your cells more stimulated, which can be bad for anxiety, it could also make them less calm. So you can have too much gas in your brain, so you're going too fast. You could also have not enough breaks, or you could have one or the other. So you see how it's like, we need to figure out, I'm going to take CBD for anxiety. If you have mutations in the endocannabinoid pathway, yeah, CBD makes the most sense. If it's a GABA mutation or an adrenaline mutation, like there's different ways. So you hit the nail on the head that it's not just symptom, give something, give any, type in anti-anxiety supplements and take any of those. No. How do these supplements affect your cells? Which pathways? And are those specific pathways not working enough or working too well? Because then there's also inflammatory pathways. I have mutations in something called the TNF-alpha gene. That's one of the primary pro-inflammatory molecules. So my immune cells, whenever they're told to release TNF-alpha, they're going to release extra. So things that help lower that. That's why I love CBD. It lowers TNF-alpha. TNF-alpha is linked to cancer, like that type of inflammation. So it's not just supporting what's low. It's blocking what can be excessive as well. And that's why finding specific herbs, you know, that, again, for me, I need to find an herb that won't affect adrenaline, that'll block TNF-alpha. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Versus someone else that has low adrenaline, that needs an energy boost, that is depressed, they may want an herb that does raises adrenaline and also addresses the TNF-alpha. And then for them, that's two birds, one stone. And that's what I love doing too, is finding supplements that address multiple mutations at once. If I can find you one supplement, one product that addresses four mutations, instead of giving you four different recommendations, you're saving a bunch of money.
Yeah.
You're going to probably feel better not taking like a huge, massive handful of pills. You know what I mean? So yeah, that's why I imagine finding the perfect puzzle piece. It's not what's going to lower my inflammation. What's going to lower my inflammation while also not affect my iron? While also maybe yes or no affect my adrenaline, while also maybe or maybe not affect my blood sugar. Wow. You know, if you're prone to high blood sugar, that's linked to, you know, obesity has a genetic component. You know, there's absolutely things that make you gain weight easier. I'm sure you probably heard that interview with the public health, whoever it was, saying how it's like all genetic, which I think most people know is garbage. But if you have chronically high blood sugar, type 2 diabetes runs in your family. Obviously, if you don't eat any carbs, you're not going to get type 2 diabetes. However, you could be more prone to that. So you could find a supplement that not only helps lower blood sugar, but also raises adrenaline. Or I'm trying to find ones that just lower blood sugar, not adrenaline. But a lot of these things, they're one and the same. I don't know if you could separate them, if that makes sense.
You mentioned the CBD. So, you know, Joe Rogan is under the impression that if you can't smoke, if you can't take THC without freaking out, that you probably have some kind of like issue with pent up fear and stuff. And I cannot do any THC. I can't do psilocybin. And, you know, Joe Rogan would say something's wrong with me and I have a lot of demons I need to tame or whatever. I am convinced it's something genetic, that there's some pathways that are keeping me from being able to process these things. What do you say?
Yeah, so I definitely think a mix of both. I think a lot of these substances, like I'm personally a big fan of cannabis. I use it every day. You know, never been a wake and bake type of guy. Always like end of the night, work is done. Just a little bit to help. My brain is always go, go, go. Like I need to just, whoosh, you know, calm that down. And I did that truth. Like bad trips on psychedelics are usually when you have some thought in your head, you realize something that you may not want to actually face. You may go back to some interaction where, wow, I was a real asshole back then. But you tell yourself, no, it's the drug. It's not real. But also, yes, there are mutations in the cannabinoid receptor that can make you much more prone to anxiety from THC. Now, I think another thing that people don't talk about is the marijuana nowadays, it's selectively bred for more and more THC. get higher, higher, higher. That's all anyone wants. They don't breed higher amounts of CBD. It's the ratios of it. Like my mom used to smoke marijuana when she was like growing up, you know, joint here or there. And she, you know, was fine. Now she has one hit of stuff from nowadays and she's like tripping out because there's like, I don't know the number, probably like 5-10 times the amount of THC. It's all about the ratios though. That's not what nature intended. We're breeding for more THC. So I would recommend, like I personally have CBD, pure CBD oil. I make it myself. I have that before I smoke each night. And that is light years of a difference because it's about the ratios there. There are also genes in that receptor that can make you more mutations that can make you more sensitive to that. But I do think for some people, I think definitely more so for the marijuana. I think marijuana is, I'm a marijuana enthusiast, but at the same point, like that can, I've really seen people get really messed up from being too high. Like I think it could be more problematic than having a bad trip in certain aspects. Everyone has that one story. They took an edible that kicked in late or something like that. You know what I mean?
I mean, I have a story of a client whose daughter was, they had schizophrenia in the family, and the daughter was in high school and she went to her first party alone and they were smoking out of one of those huge volcano thingies. She got extra high. She came home and was sick for days.
Yep.
And then went back to school. Her mom got like a week later, got a call from her mom that she was running around the school in her bra and panties and claiming that she was Jesus, and not long, and she's still basically in the hospital now.
Yeah. Yeah. That's absolutely true. Cannabis, psychedelics, they can absolutely aggravate pre-existing psychiatric conditions. Like I definitely don't think. Yeah. So there's that. And then there's also, have you ever heard of Delta 8 THC before?
No.
So Delta 9 THC, that's the THC that we're used to getting high off of. Delta 8 THC, it's one molecular difference, one minor change in the molecular structure. And it's normally found in marijuana and hemp, but very low amounts. But you can concentrate it. And that is by far my favorite version of THC. That one molecular change makes it infinitely, all the side effects are pretty much gone. It's all benefits. Wow. So calming. Highly, highly recommend like anyone that would be interested, but like I've so many people that I've come in contact with that say, I used to smoke, I don't anymore. I get anxious now. A, like I said, the weed is more potent, not enough CBD. And B, we're just growing up. Like you're not in college anymore. You got bills to worry about. So you get high and you're thinking about these things and you're like, oh, I got this deadline. That lets your brain spiral. But Delta 8 THC, it's legal. Like it's a different molecule. So it's technically legal. And much, much smoother over. I've had so many people that say they can't handle regular cannabis and they try Delta 8 THC and it's like, wow, this is what marijuana looks like in the movies. Instead of the heart racing, you like hear your air conditioner. You're like, what the fuck is that? You know what I mean? When you're like two, and that's the Delta 9 aspect of that. So back to your initial question, I definitely think it's a mixture of both. Like a lot of the epiphany type things I've had, whether it's about my life, my trajectory in life, or even scientific ideas that I've had, a lot of them came under the influence of cannabis for me because it increases creativity. Yeah, that can also be a gateway to, they unlock things in your brain that your brain may have repressed. So it's a mixture of both. I think some people just get so anxious, like their heart is pounding out of their chest, not because they're not addressing something in their subconscious, just because there's so much THC raises your heart rate, just fact. So if you have no tolerance, you don't take a low enough of a dose, there's no CBD in it, like your heart's going to be pounding regardless. Then there are also people that sit there, different type of anxiety. They're sitting there and maybe they're thinking about like, damn, man, I've been trying to go to the gym for the past 6 months. I haven't done shit. I've been trying to do this. I haven't been doing that. Man, I'm really fucking up right now. And then they're like, they try to resist it instead of being like, wow, this is telling me something. I need to step up my game. They'll be like, how long has it been? I don't want to be high anymore. You know, the second on any drug, the second you say, I want it to be over, you're screwed, you know, because because then you got to sit there. Oh my God, how it's only been a half hour. Well, you've been so deep in your own thoughts, thinking how you haven't before. It alters your consciousness, how you view things.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's overly paranoia. You know, the government's out to kill me right now because I smoked a joint, but sometimes it's letting you know, hey, you got to step up your game in life, or hey, you were a little rude to your friend on that phone call yesterday. Maybe you should just say, hey, what's up? My bad. You know, but people will shove that aside because it's just a drug. It's not real. The drug just alters your own brain. Sometimes you're just tripping and like, it's not, you know, based in anything, but I think a lot of the time it's your body telling you something in this altered state. It's your subconscious speaking to you.
Yeah. Because we have these receptors, we have cannabinoid receptors and pathways. We have psilocybin receptors and we have chocolate receptors and pathways. Yep. So like we're, you know, God designed us to uptake this medicine for some reason. And if you're not able to, we have to investigate, pull out the scalpel, I feel like. But I've definitely been pulling out the scalpel on the psilocybin and marijuana thing for a long time and just
sitting there. And now, was yours a microdose or a macrodose of psilocybin?
Well, back with the psilocybin, back in the day, it was, you know, more like let's just do this and muscle test it and see how much to take. I never microdosed, but that has come across recently as something that I should try. And so I might look into that.
And now it's really interesting.
I might hire you first and find out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's ironic. I was just going to touch on that point too. Remember I told you about that serotonin 1A receptor mutation that like CBD helps with, ashwagandha makes it worse? The serotonin 2A receptor, this is the receptor that serotonin binds to. It's also what psychedelics bind to. Psilocybin binds to. So when I've worked with clients that have a receptor mutation there, it doesn't work as well. You know, I'm not providing or sourcing any of these things, you know, but just letting them know, you know, some of them were like, hey, I've been, you know, interested in maybe trying microdosing. I have a friend and I'm like, you know, make sure, you know, your risk for sourcing that, make sure it's safe and everything, you know, but looking at the genes, that specific serotonin receptor needs more signaling. So psychedelics microdosing makes perfect sense for you. And those are some of the clients I've seen that on their own accord, they go and try microdosing. And for the first time in their entire life, all those negative voices in their head that they have constantly, within an hour, boom, gone. Like for the first time, they're like crying, like for the first time in their life, like, oh my God. Like me personally, I don't really do well in the microdose. Microdosing mushrooms makes me feel a little weird personally. And maybe that's just because I'm not really, really depressed. I tried it. Microdosing LSD, I felt more creative, but I also had these like tension headaches. So I felt creative and energized, but headaches. LSD also binds dopamine receptors. So since I already have high dopamine, I think that might have tightened my blood vessels in my brain and led to those headaches.
That's so interesting. I mean, it's the reason why like I do really well on benzos. You know, I don't take them often, but I mean, I do so well. I do really well on things like ecstasy and things like LSD. But if I go into the medicinal mushroom, marijuana, THC, good luck. Like, you know, I it's definitely a whole different experience.
Yeah. And I mean, MDMA. So like the pure component of ecstasy, MDMA is, that's probably the one supplement. Well, I guess it could be a supplement. Hey. that's the one substance drug. I, as a pharmacologist with extensive experience in neuropsychopharmacology, so how psychoactive drugs affect the brain, that's the one substance, without a doubt, every human being on the face of the earth should try at least once.
Oh, should. I thought you were going to say should never.
No, because that is, there's no, all it is raising serotonin. It's making you happier, more open. The results for PTSD are astounding.
Yeah.
I think in a couple of years now, the next new wave is going to be couples therapy with MDMA. I think that's going to revolutionize like divorce counseling, all those types of things, because you have two people that are unhappy in a marriage. Regular therapy, you try to talk it out, you get to the one point, and then whichever the male or female or whatever it is, one of them is just like, they hit that wall. They're like, I'm so sick of this same stuff. You don't actually listen. You're just, you don't want to deal with it. And MDMA can open you up and let you actually listen and say, huh, I hear what you're saying now. Well, this is how I feel. And you're not going to have that knee-jerk response where it's like see, you're saying it again, or this, and that same context. And I'm so confident in that, because what's PTSD? PTSD is you're trying to talk with a therapist about a harmful thing that happened to you, traumatic thing. You get to where you say, so tell me about that day. You lock up, you freeze, because your brain is defending you. And that's why MDMA is having such a, I literally have goosebumps right now. And that's why MDMA is having such amazing success with PTSD, because they don't lock up. They feel good. They feel loose. And they'll talk about this. And then let's just say the therapist, you know, will mention, well, from what you told me here, it looks like that wasn't your fault and you had no control over the situation, whatever the bad moment was.
Yeah.
Then in that moment, when they're feeling this, then their soul and their body will accept, wait a second, instead of being, no, it's my fault, I suck, you know, that's their body will accept it and be like, wait a second, it wasn't my fault. Mm-hmm. And that's what can cause that shift, like the click in the body, the epigenetic changes to undo the PTSD. So yeah, that's, I definitely don't think, I do not think everyone should do psychedelic, like macro dose psilocybin, LSD. I do not. I think it could benefit a lot of people, not everybody. Mm-hmm. Ayahuasca guided could be good as well, but that can also be equally as traumatic possibly because you're really going deep. MDMA, you don't really go deep into your subconscious. You could just be comfortable talking about anything.
Yeah. And it's like, it does something to empathy, right?
Yes.
It makes you super empathic with others. Yep. And so,
well, that's why you won't shut somebody up. You'll listen to them because you're like, wait, this person that I've spent years, decades of my life with every day, they're telling me something that hurt them. Yeah. Rather than trying to deflect blame, that might be my fault. And then, you know, relative to these other, like they're using like, I think 0.1 grams for these doses for the MDMA trials, which is not a high dose. Like, don't get me wrong. You're rolling, you're feeling pretty good, but relative to like a hot, like a mushroom trip, like your brain is much more like normal, if that makes sense. You know, you're not like trip, like the difference in consciousness is much less pronounced with MDMA. You know, you're not you're just feeling very happy and good. Like regular psychedelics can get really weird. You know, someone says one wrong sentence and you're like, all these emotions, how did we end up here?
You can hallucinate. And,
exactly.
And you don't really hallucinate on MDMA.
No.
But
and that's
also,
why.
It's also what you just described about like you're hearing your spouse and you're like, wait, that could have. It also seems to happen on a really, really like nervous system level. It's not just like, oh.
No, the whole body. That's because the rational
on
the
somatic
brain.
Level.
The somatic level. And you know, I'm not sure the exact pathway, but you know, the brain. Like, I'm a spiritual guy and like I love the deep science, but there's a lot of stuff science can't prove yet. And it's like the brain speaks to the body. You feel that tension really just go away. It's not like your brain is telling you, I just feel good. Like you feel so comfortable with people. Like there's all these memes of people at raves and stuff, how you can't help but say, I love you to all your friends. Like some of my friends, you know, like I'm big in electronic music, go figure. Love DJing, all that type of stuff. But I think music are, you know, it used to be just partying, raving, but I think music is a tool to alter cell biology. We know music itself can help grow brain cells.
Wow.
So can some of these substances. And like, put them both together. That's why a lot of people have been combining them for so long. But I think doing that under the right environment, the right frequencies, you know, not at a big warehouse party, nothing like that, you know, very, you know, the psychotherapy stuff, they have people with blindfolds on and they'll play calming music because it helps the body drift and feel at ease with these things.
Right.
You're not just listening to your own thoughts.
I think Paul Stamets, they were using microdosing psilocybin and they were doing the same thing with counseling people with, you know, blinders on and it's a really, really successful. Gosh, I've taken so much of your time and I didn't even get to some of the questions that people.
Oh, we can still keep going if you want to. I have a little more time if you'd like.
Okay. Yeah. Let me just hit on some of these things. I offer the Dutch test for people so we can get, which is a dried urine test that, you know, helps a lot to show us what people are doing with their hormones, like what they're doing with their estrogen, how they're metabolizing it and excreting ultimately. And But on that test, there is a methylation. There's a like, are you an under or over methylator? And I'm just curious. I know I could probably just ask the company, but when you're an under or over methylator, is that something you are forever, kind of like slow comped or fast comped? Or is it like you can like I can be an under methylator before when I was cycling normally, and now that I'm in almost in menopause, I could be an over methylator.
Yeah, so yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, so I'm not exactly sure regarding specifically, women's cycles, menopause with that. But in general, methylation status is far more easy to change and manipulate based on what you're putting into your body, what supplements are putting into your body. So, like, I've seen people that are genetically, trying to get a word this. I've seen people that are genetically under methylators take so many supplements to support methylation. Now they're horrifically under methylated, or vice versa. So you can really, the main readout is homocysteine. That's the main way to tell if you're methylated. Usually you want around 7. I usually like to see probably, I don't know, 6.5-ish to 7.5. Even 8 is pretty good, but I've seen people with genes that mean they should have high homocysteine and it's tanked because they're taking so much methyl B vitamins, so many of these other things. So yeah, I'm familiar with the Dutch test in that I've had some clients send it to me and I've tried to reverse engineer it with some mutations and I have seen some things that coincide together. I'm not an expert on it by any means, but the one thing I'm not don't really like about the Dutch test is, for example, those mutations I mentioned in receptors, so how sensitive you are to things. You can show up on a Dutch test for normal melatonin. Well, guess what? Normal melatonin levels, metabolite levels. Well, guess what? If you have mutations in your melatonin receptors, which I do, a lot of people do, your cells aren't as sensitive to melatonin. So it'll look normal in the Dutch test. You won't try supplementing melatonin, which for the record, that and vitamin D, I think, are the two most overly demonized supplements out there. Melatonin actually helps your body make glutathione, a lot of good antioxidant effects. You don't want to overdo it every single night. Like, usually people need a much lower dose than you think, but you get what I'm saying. The levels, it's kind of like a blood test.
I
It's
was
just
going to
telling you the
say.
levels of something. But if your cells are less responsive to it, you may need to have a little bit more. So that's why, like I mentioned, the vitamin D. To most people, they'd say like 90 is a very high level for vitamin D. Well, there's been no documented issues in the literature until you're well over 150, which is crazy, crazy high. I never have clients over 100. And you try it out for a little bit, see how you feel. Most people feel great. With all the data I use, I always go by symptoms first, how the client feels. The genes line up the vast majority of the time. Sometimes they'll all point to this supplement, they take it. They don't feel right. And then you know what? You wasted $20 on a bottle, and we have a whole other list of stuff we could try. So you always go by, I call it fitting the square peg into the round hole. You never just want to beat it in there. And I think a lot of people too, the whole thing of, oh, I'm detoxing, that's why I feel like crap, which can be true, but I think it's overused. Detox symptoms should last a week or two tops. People will be taking, like I mentioned, these adrenaline raising supplements. Oh, I've been detoxing for 3 months. That's why I'm stressed. No, you haven't. You're just jacking up your adrenaline, and that's never going to go away until you get off that supplement.
Okay, let's see.
Well, melatonin has been shown to help with COVID, like viral infections, because again,
Yeah.
it's not, think of the mechanism. Melatonin doesn't fight viral infections. It boosts glutathione, which then fights viral infections. So what else is glutathione good for? Basically every disease. I mentioned Alzheimer's. All these chronic diseases are linked to lower glutathione. So you could take an NAC, but if you don't sleep that well, maybe take a melatonin instead. If you're sulfur sensitive, so can't do well with NAC, and you don't sleep that well, you have melatonin receptor mutations, you're going to boost glutathione through melatonin.
And people that take melatonin and say, I have terrible dreams, I really don't like it, I
Too
wake up
much.
groggy,
Too
too
high of a
much.
dose. I break so The same enzyme that breaks down melatonin actually breaks down caffeine, which is sort of ironic. I have slow metabolism of that. My wife is fast. She takes like five times the melatonin dose I do. She wakes up every morning, bounces out of bed.
Yeah, that's me.
I take a very low dose And if I'm not careful, I'll still wake up groggy the next day. Wow. It's only for this hour. So like I get over it. I think the good sleep is worth that. But now that I figured out my dose, I take a very low dose of it. That's all I need. And it's interesting that I'm also sensitive to caffeine in the morning. So I don't need it throughout the day. If I have anything past like 9 a.m., like I'm not sleeping that night, it also makes me sensitive to melatonin. So it's kind of interesting. I think that also ties into day, night owls, morning bird people.
Right.
If you break down melatonin fast, you're going to wake up with low melatonin. So you're going to be, boom, I'm up. Versus someone that breaks it down slower, they may have a harder time waking up in the morning because by the time it's time to wake up, the melatonin their body released isn't broken down as much.
Interesting. Yeah. My Celtico says I have higher chance of having high glutamate. What do you think about that?
Yeah. So that's something I see a lot as well. High glutamate, it's an excitatory neurotransmitter. So it's sort of similar to histamine. Like Benadryl, antihistamines put us to bed. So what does high histamine do? Keep us up. Same thing with dopamine. Same thing with adrenaline. Then you have things like GABA. Even serotonin is calmer as well. Kind of evens you out. Glutamate is linked to things like neuroticism. They've done studies showing people with higher glutamate tend to get their feelings hurt easier by other people. So sensitive to other people. OCD as well. I'm trying to think of – those are the main ones I could think of now. And there's a lot of mechanisms that can cause that. So you can have mutations so you synthesize more glutamate. I'm trying to remember the exact pathway off the top of my head. I forgot if glutamate goes – I think glutamate gets turned into GABA. So you can either be creating more glutamate through the enzymes or you could be converting less of it into GABA so more of it stays as glutamate. But there's ingredients, supplements like taurine and theanine. Those actually both help convert glutamate into GABA. So kind of like trades, it doesn't just lower glutamate. You're going from this to this. So you're kind of helping switch things up like that.
Okay.
Glutamate, people can be more sensitive to processed foods. MSG, monosodium glutamate, can be more sensitive to that.
Yeah.
And I have seen some clients sensitive to certain collagen products, which can be higher in glutamate as well.
Okay.
That's honestly something. There's been a couple of clients I've seen with that, you know, kind of one of those working hypotheses. But if you do look into it, collagen can have high amounts of glutamate. So it makes sense.
Yeah.
So yeah, more sensitive to things like MSG. And it's funny, a lot of the people with these glutamate mutations, I mentioned the feeling like your feeling gets hurt a lot. And they're like, oh my fucking God. Yes. Like, oh my God. Like that is me. Just poor resilience to other people's like whatever like that. And it's so fascinating seeing that line up like that.
It's embarrassing actually. it's so me, but okay. What about motion sickness? So all my life and so many people, including Constantine, just like how, I mean, impossible to correct. It seems. Do you have anything
to think
say about that?
I'm pretty positive there's a histamine link to it.
Yeah.
So that's honestly as far as I really know about that. But like how my brain works here is look at a couple reviews on molecular drivers of motion sickness. And there'd be histamine, maybe some other pathways. And then I go and start looking. What are the major genes there? Are they mutated? Are they on self-decode? And then that's how, you know, you have motion sickness. You figure out which drive. Remember the Alzheimer's thing I gave you. You know, it could be histamine, this, that.
Yeah.
We figure out which things are heavily mutated and take it from there. So that's kind of why it's like
detective work.
Exactly. And it's like, I don't even really know where the limit is for this stuff. Like I mentioned, I'm not going on the record saying I could cure Alzheimer's with natural supplements this way. Not yet, at least. But people with early stage cognitive decline from Alzheimer's have gotten significant improvements. And like, I don't know, why wouldn't this work to help reverse chronic diseases as well? You know, can you reverse late stage? The later stage, the harder it will be, you know, to get those improvements. But just intuitively thinking, why would it not work? And that's why I'm so excited for the future, because I've only been doing this, what, 8-9 months as a business, maybe a month and a half full time. And I'm just getting started, you know, and like, it's going to be way more than just the holistic space. Right now, I'm very deeply rooted in the holistic space, but I want to get more involved with people that aren't as super health conscious, meaning a good amount of the clients I work with are already taking a lot of good supplements. But imagine someone that takes no supplements, that, you know, is not in the holistic space at all. They're going to have so much more room they can improve on, because they're not taking, like, some people will come to me taking five products I was going to recommend already. And I'm like, good job, but they're not going to get as much improvement just from me, if that makes sense, because they're already on some of the right stuff. But most people, we're a small, small subset of people. Most people don't give a crap about their health. I could give them three or four recommendations to take once a day and it'll change their life, because again, their health is much poorer. Even if they may not have the chronic mold and stuff, just some of these basics can help so much more. So that's why I'm just really trying to get the message out overall.
Oh, maybe it's a really good time for me to hire you then, because for Lent, I gave up all my supplements, even my progesterone for 40 days. It's been 20 days now. I gave up booze and I gave up all my supplements.
Yeah.
And so it's been very interesting. So it'd be a good time to get on board.
Well, I honestly love that, because I love nothing more when I get a client that is on no supplements, on no medications. It's a clean slate.
Yeah.
Because I also work with people to get off prescription medication. So I've had people that are on Adderall, antidepressant meds, and Xanax every day. And it's a much longer process. You know, you got to be more delicate with things. I can't use CBD because that'll interact with the medication. So my toolkit's limited. But first we do is support certain pathways to get them feeling better, in a better spot. Once they're like, all right, I'm a level up, I'm better now, then the next phase is weaning them off the medications while also giving them certain nutrients, because the withdrawals can be very brutal. Mm. So you need to, if you're taking away a drug that makes serotonin in your brain, you got to give your cells ingredients to make serotonin. You got to do it. I wouldn't recommend anyone do this on their own, because technically they're conflicting. Like, you should not take supplements that make more serotonin while you're on a drug that prevent serotonin reuptake, because then you could have too much serotonin. Mm. But that's why, and this is something I always do, I always want to make sure the prescribing physician's on board with this. You know, like, I'm not the prescribed, like, you know, I'm not a vigilante that's like, screw the doctors. You know, I always want to make sure when you're weaning off this stuff, the doctor needs to be aware. But that's why under expert care, we're slowly replacing it. So your serotonin levels, you know, may not be a cakewalk, but they're not going to tank as low, and then you're going to have to relapse and take more of the medication. You'll soften the blow over time, and then over a couple of months, you've replaced that with a natural thing. And here's the thing. A lot of people on SSRIs, they won't even have serotonin mutations. They may not even be – serotonin may not be that big of an issue for them. It could be neuroplasticity. So they need something like CBD or magnesium or lion's mane mushroom, or even possibly microdosing psychedelics. They help grow new brain cells that way. So,
Well, I think that's all incredible. I am so grateful for your time, really. It's been such an education. I mean, I'm blown away. I have to listen to this and listen again, because there's so many mind bombs that you drop. All your info's in the show notes. I appreciate your time. This has honestly been mind blowing for me. And I think that you've got a new client.
Awesome. Well, yeah, looking forward to working with you and everyone listening, whether it's you or everyone knows someone that's not happy with where their current health is at. I think so many people take that 3 p.m. slump in the day as normal. It's not normal. You should be full with vitality each and every day. You shouldn't be in pain. We're all human. We're all going to have our bad days, our bad weeks. But if you're really looking for a new, fresh perspective on this, please feel free to reach out. Not a doubt in my mind, this is going to revolutionize not just the health and wellness little niche that we're in so deeply, but overall medical practice, everything as well. And I think it makes a lot of sense. Obviously, I'm biased here, starting with the genes, because you get a framework. It may not fix everything, but you will always get answers. You will always get some level of improvement, because everyone has these mutations, some sort of these mutations that can be improved upon. And then let's just say you're not totally fixed. Then when you go to that mold specialist or parasite specialist, you have a list of supplements that won't agree with your body. So you can custom tailor your continued support after that, versus vice versa. People coming to me, I spent $60,000 on tests the past year, got no results. I'm doing this detox. I feel like crap. And then I look and I see up this, that. And a lot of it could have possibly been prevented. So thank you so much for having me. Definitely want to come on again. And all you guys listening, I really hope that you guys learned something.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I had during the interview, you may or may not have realized that I had this realization, like this aha moment that I needed to send him my data. Like I needed to go ahead and hire him. And I'll tell you, all transparency, he's definitely expensive, but I think for what he's doing, I think it's actually going to save you loads of money in the long run. And here's the reason. So those of you who've been following me, you know how much work I do. You know how much effort I put towards my self-care and my health and supplements and seeing practitioners and all of the things that a lot of you guys do as well. And, you know, I'm not rolling in money. So these things I have to budget very carefully. I have to be very specific about the way that I choose to spend my money in regards to my health because I can overdo it. And in fact, I also am going to be having a podcast coming out soon that is about my 40 days off of self-care and what that was like. Because sometimes I wonder if I overdo it, right? And so that's coming up as well. So all of this happened at the same time after I did the 40 days off of my self-care routine. I then hired Dr. Tyler to basically start fresh and start from this new perspective of knowing what my genetic variations are, knowing what is hindering me from my body behaving physiologically normal, if you will. And because all this work I've done, I look at my husband and I'm like, I do all this work. And if I skip like a week of magnesium, it shows up. You know, I have reactions to certain supplements that I shouldn't be having. You know, I still have to take, you know, progesterone, and I may always have to, and I'm fine with that. But my point is, like, why are there certain things? Why do I still deal with certain things? Yes, I'm human, but when I compare myself to my husband or to other people that I know, like, they don't do this much self-care. Like, if I stop my self-care, am I just going to die because I just have, you know, this many imbalances and issues? So anyway, I thought, you know what? I need to find out if there are some genetic mutations that are keeping me from physiologically responding as I should. Well, guess what? Almost everything he kind of talked about in the episode turns out that I actually have those things, which was not planned. He had not seen my data yet. I had not hired him yet. And it turns out that, you know, I do have, and I was told in the past that I did not have the MTHFR. For those of you that don't know what that is, it's a genetic mutation that affects your ability to detoxify at the liver. And that's a short definition of it. It's quite a complex situation because, as he mentioned, you can have all kinds of variations of those SNPs, they're called SNP. And so I have these genetic mutations that I have every genetic mutation that affects my ability to absorb, make, convert vitamin D, which makes so much sense from the moment I was born. It just makes sense. Low immunity, constantly battling with immune system issues. You know, it. There was also a mutation, the one he talks about with metallothionein, which is an enzyme that helps us chelate naturally heavy metals from our bodies. So I have done countless heavy metal tests, and this might relate to a lot of you. Countless heavy metal tests and heavy metal detoxes. I've done a handful of very serious heavy metal detoxification protocols. I've done everything except for, you know, chelation therapy. And I do great. And then I have like another hair mineral analysis test done, and there my metals are high again. I thought, what is going on? Is it my environment? Am I exposed to more metals than the average person? Like, what is do I eat that much sushi? Going on and on, like, what is going on? And it turns out that I have these variants that I don't make metallothionine, which means, or I don't make it effectively, which means I have a slower time chelating the metals I'm exposed to, right? I have a slower time detoxifying the metals that I am exposed to, including, so that obviously you can see that's going to also having the MTHFR is also going to affect my ability to detox. So I know a lot of you can relate to that because you know, you start to wonder, why do I get taken down so easily by certain things, regardless of how much effort I put towards, you know, all the right things. And so this, I don't recommend this particular consultation for everybody, but for those of you, especially in the group and women out there who struggle with Lyme disease and who struggle with, you know, EBV, and they're constantly dealing with inflammatory markers and they do everything that they can and they still battle with mysterious symptoms and they can't seem to get ahead of the issues, I highly recommend, you know, saving up and seeing Dr. Tyler Pansner. I think this information can really help tremendously. So there's a lot of things he showed me. I think he showed me like the top 5 to 10 variants that he thinks have a strong impact on my health and what to do about them. And so I was doing a lot of the right things already, but interestingly enough, I was doing a lot of the wrong things and I did not realize it. And for example, you know, a lot of people say, okay, let's talk about the vitamin D controversy, right? Everyone's like, you're either in one camp or you're in another, or like me, you bounced from one camp to another. And the people who are in each camp are very, very passionate about it. Do not take vitamin D. It is a hormone. It can hurt you, right? And then the other camp is, there is so much research to show how beneficial supplementing vitamin D is for you. It is beyond an argument. There is no argument to be had. It is a done deal. Put the nail in the coffin. This debate is done. Well, this information sheds light. The variants, what you do with your vitamin D is going to make a drastic difference in how you are supplementing it or not taking it or how you absorb it. For example, it looks like I should not be supplementing D unless I am doing it with these particular things. Like, you know, I have to have adequate vitamin K. And he even mentioned taking a broken down form of D that I still need to investigate further. To bypass all those conversions because my body is not doing those conversions. I mean, that is absolutely fascinating. And so you can see how each individual person will have a different outcome based on their genetic variations. And so that's partially why the misinformation or the conflicting information on the internet and out there amongst experts who have been debating different subjects for so long, and partially why this can be so varying from person to person, from, you know what I'm saying? Like, it makes sense that it's a big argument because guess what? They're not taking into consideration each person's variants to deal with each supplement or each food or whatever it is. And then just because you might have the MTHFR doesn't mean it's a blanket statement because you don't know necessarily which versions of it you have. And even if you do know, your other variants in other areas can affect how you detoxify versus someone who has the same MTHFR, the same copies of the MTHFR. You see what I'm saying? Like your version, maybe you just have those two variants and this person has two variants plus this other variant that might make the outcome different. So we can't make these blanket statements about supplementation when it comes to, you know, recommending something for someone. I hope that wasn't confusing. I'm sure if you're brand new here and you don't know what the heck I'm talking about, I apologize for that. But this has been a long awaited for episode. We needed somebody like this who is super savvy in this area. And I think he did a really good job of explaining everything. If you want to reach out to him, you can look in the show notes and look at his coupon codes and his all the things that he's offering. He's incredible. I do not think he's going to be this price for much longer. Even though it is pricey, I think it's going to go up and he's going to be harder to book with because I think he's just an up-and-coming guy who I think is getting a lot of attention. So if you guys, you know, want to work with him, you should do so as soon as you can. Anyway, I can't wait to do my next episode about my 40 days in the wilderness without self-care so I can share all the interesting things that I've learned. And I hope you enjoy this episode and we'll catch you again later.